Lizzie Borden took an axe. She gave her mother 40 whacks. When she saw what she had done, she gave her father 41.
On a seemingly normal morning, Lizzie Borden, an unmarried woman of 32, living with her wealthy father and stepmother, is said to have ruthlessly and mercilessly killed her parents with an axe in a fit of fury. The sight was gruesome. Both Andrew and Abby were barely recognizable. But how much of the rhyme and the echoes through time surrounding Lizzie's story are true? Today, I'm telling you the true tale of Lizzie Borden. Hello, everyone. I'm your host, Megan, and welcome back to Haunted History. Today's episode is one that most of you are likely familiar with. Over the years, there's been countless movies, shows, and books surrounding the Borden murders, but it still leaves people divided and with the burning question, did she do it? Today, we will explore the theories around this gruesome murder, and then you can decide for yourself if you think she's guilty or innocent. All right, let's get to today's story. To start our story, let's venture back to 19th century New England. Lizzie Andrew Borden was born on July 19, 1860, in the small, quaint town of Fall River in Massachusetts. Her parents, Andrew Jackson Borden and Sarah Anthony Morse Borden, brought two other children into the world before Lizzie: her sister, Emma Lenora, and Alice Esther. Unfortunately, little Alice, who was born 4 years before Lizzie, died just before she reached the age of two. And this was unfortunately very common in the 19th century colonies. There had been, little medical advancements, and the mortality rate was high, especially among children. One of the more significant events of Lizzie's life happened when she herself was just over 2 years old. On March 26, 1863, Lizzie's mother, Sarah, tragically passed away at the young age of 39. Historical records show that she passed after complications from a miscarriage. On her deathbed, Lizzie's oldest surviving sister, Emma, promised their dying mother that she would always watch over little Lizzie. All in all, Lizzie's early family life was tinged with tragedy. This set the tone for a life that would be tainted with the after effects of such early trauma. Lizzie Borden's father, Andrew, is a man who can be characterized as intensely and perpetually frugal, most certainly to a fault. By 1714, the Borden family, brimming with wealth at this point, owned much of Fall River. Andrew himself was an eighth-generation high society man. Modesty, however, ran deep in certain circles of the family. Andrew apprenticed as a carpenter in his early years and even helped build the house where he would eventually live and die decades later, a three-story home at 92nd Street. Many of the Bordens, excluding Andrew, lived in a posh upper-class area called The Hill. They owned many businesses in town and made up much of the upper crust of Fall River society, making them fairly influential in the social fabric of the town. Andrew's father had not inherited the wealth that befell the other members of the Borden name. He was but a simple fishmonger. Perhaps the fact that Andrew was rich only in his namesake bolstered him. From an early age, he was committed to garnering wealth for himself. Andrew found a niche for himself as an undertaker and eventually partnered up with another man named William M. Almy. After taking out a loan, the two men became business partners and successfully manufactured caskets. Andrew may have gotten a head start due to his family's predispositions in town, but he was also carving a niche out for himself as an undertaker. It was a grim job for a grim man. Andrew Borden was not only known for his frugality, but also for his less than sunny predisposition. It's said that rain or shine, summer or winter, Andrew Borden would be dressed head to toe in black, double-breasted, Prince Albert-style jackets. So think the classic Victorian-style jacket with the long tail and a string tie. It was austere and highly identifiable. And it was no secret that Andrew loved money. He grew his influence and coffers by investing in real estate and serving as the director of several local textile mills. He also became the president of the Union Savings Bank and even the director of two other banks. His wealth was growing, and he was on a steady course to becoming a millionaire. However, with his wife having passed and two daughters to care for, it was high time for him to find a new wife. On June 6th, 2 years after the death of his wife, Andrew remarried. His new wife, named Abigail Abby Durfee Gray, was 37 years old at the time that they wed and was considered an old maid. By the standards of the times, Andrew marrying Abby was unusual because the Durfee name was below in status to the Borden name. However, it was common practice in general for widowers to remarry in order to have help with the housework and child rearing in the home. In April of 1872, Andrew purchased the house at 92 Second Street. Little did he know at the time, this house would become the site of one of the most famous crimes in the United States. Now, it should be said that by this point, Andrew had accrued significant wealth and was becoming a true blue Borden by name, by accomplishment, and status. However, that's where the line ends. There was no fancy house on the hill with the other Bordens. No. Andrew was perfectly content in a house away from the more fashionable hill neighborhood. His house had none of the newer conveniences, such as electricity and plumbing. In the Borden household, lights were kept on by way of gas, which was outdated even for then, and seen as unspeakable for someone of such wealth. Andrew could have easily afforded these small changes, which would have made the living situation in the Borden household that much cozier and amiable, but perhaps the house just reflected his inner temperament. Historical records vary as to what life looked like in the Borden household. Needless to say, in the event of stories with such a macabre and famous undertone, some parts ran rampant and were exaggerated. Andrew Borden employed a 25-year-old live-in maid named Bridget Sullivan, affectionately and inexplicably called Maggie by the Borden girls, who could later provide insight into the relationships between the Borden family members. According to Maggie, the Borden sisters, Lizzie and Emma, rarely ate meals with their father and stepmother. What's more, it's said that Lizzie always referred to her stepmother in a formal fashion, such as Mrs. Borden. So seemingly, no love lost there. Because the Durfees were lower in status than the Bordens, and especially due to the fact that Andrew Borden was amassing a sizable fortune on his own right, it's said that Lizzie feared that Abby had designs on the family's expanding fortune. Growing up, Lizzie and Emma were both highly religious. Lizzie even taught Sunday school, served as the secretary treasurer of the Christian Endeavor Society, and was involved in the local women's temperance movement. Historians have waded through the mucky details surrounding Lizzie's case and painted together a portrait of a plump and gentle lady, one who stuck up birdhouses all over her garden, painted on porcelain, and by all accounts seemed to have been involved in charitable organizations. However, at her eventual trial, witnesses would sling forth stories of how she would crucify kittens and robins because she liked to hold funerals. This was never substantiated and could have easily been town gossip meant to stir the pot. It is said, though, that in May of 1892, Lizzie had intentionally built a roost for some pigeons that had been grooming in the rafters, and her father, Andrew, cold-heartedly killed those very same pigeons with a hatchet, believing them to be pests. This rumor has become part of the Lizzie Borden lore, but it had never concretely been substantiated. What is certain, however, is that at some point before the murders, tensions in the household were so ripe that Lizzie and Emma took an extended vacation following a family row and hunkered down in New Bedford, Massachusetts. They eventually made their way back home a week before the murder. Lizzie, however, needed some extra time to cool off, as she stayed an extra 4 days in a local rooming house before setting foot back into the Borden home. One thing is for sure, Lizzie and her sister were at odds with their father and stepmother when it came to their values and how they spent the Borden money. It's said that in the months before the horrid crime would be committed, Andrew was handing over property to various family members of the Durfee clan. Their stepmother's sister received a house, which prompted both Lizzie and Emma to ask their father to give them a house as well. They chose the house that they had grown up in until their mother died, and a few weeks later, it's said that they sold this property back to their father for the sum of $5,000, which is around $170,000 in today's money. Because of his reluctance to set the girls up independently, marriage prospects were few and far between for Lizzie and Emma. The sisters, by all accounts, had been doomed to spinsterhood. Interestingly, the girl's maternal uncle, John Morse, is said to have visited the Borden household on the night before the crime was committed. Tense discussions regarding Morse and Borden's property transfers are said to have ensued, perhaps further fueling the discord in the household. Was this enough, however, to commit the unspeakable acts that occurred at 92nd Street? As the month of August rolled into Fall River, the Borden household was befallen with a sudden and violent illness. A family friend suspected that spoiled mutton was to blame, but Abby had hinted that since her husband was a shady businessman and not overwhelmingly loved in the town, she feared that they had been poisoned. On August 3rd, as I mentioned earlier, John Morse, the brother of the late Sarah Morse, came to visit the Borden household. That night, he slept in the guest bedroom. Upon awakening, Andrew Borden, Abby Borden, John Morse, and the live-in maid, Maggie, all enjoyed breakfast together. The men then excused themselves and retired to a side room where they had a spirited exchange. John is said to have then left the Borden residence at 8:45 in order to buy a couple of oxen and visit with a cousin in Fall River. Andrew, for his part, is said to have left the house for his customary morning walk shortly after, around 9 a.m. Typically, making up the guest bedroom was one of Lizzie and Emma's chores. However, it appears that Abby headed upstairs after her husband left and found herself face to face with her killer. In what was certainly a shocking and brutal attack, Abby was struck on the side of the head with a hatchet. The brute force of the hit, cutting just above the ear, propelled her sideways and caused her to fall and land on the floor. Her killer then hovered momentarily over her before barreling down on her with 17 hatchet whacks behind the head. So not 40 whacks, but more like half. It was about 18. As was his custom, Andrew Borden returned from his morning walk, apparently none the wiser. Upon arrival at the house, he found that his key jammed in the lock. Unable to open the front door, he knocked feverishly. Maggie, who by all accounts was still in the house at this point, raced to open the door from the inside. She also struggled for a moment with the front door as it was effectively, solidly jammed. Later, during her testimony in court, Maggie would say that she uttered a curse word in reaction to her frustration, and she heard Lizzie's laughter echoing from the second floor. This is significant, as Andrew Borden is said to have returned by 10:30 a.m., by which time Abby Borden was already very dead. Shaking off her frustration, Maggie led her boss inside. Andrew, no doubt fatigued from his walk and having no idea about the carnage upstairs, had his daughter Lizzie remove his boots and he laid down on the couch for a nap. When Lizzie Borden found her father's body on the couch, his face was beyond anything remotely recognizable as human. Reduced to a pulp, the figure of Andrew Borden had been bludgeoned to bits. She screamed and beckoned for Maggie. "Maggie, come quick. Father's dead. Somebody came and killed him." Maggie, who had been busy cleaning the windows on the third floor at the time, came rushing into the first floor room. Panicked, the maid ran to fetch a neighbor named Adelaide Churchill, as well as a local doctor, Dr. Bowen. Adelaide was the first to find Abby's body on the second floor. The police, as you can imagine, were quickly summoned. One of their first orders of business was to scope out potential intruders, and failing that, any signs of forced entry. In both cases, they found none. Next in line was the murder weapon. Both victims appeared to have been killed using a small hatchet. Andrew Borden, it was later found, suffered 10 to 11 blows, all localized to his face. It was not lost on anyone that Abby suffered the most blows, although Andrew's wounds attempted to destroy his face in what can be also surmised as his personhood or mask to the world. In the basement, police were quick to locate three potential weapons. Two hatchets and two axes were found. But another finding was of special interest to them. A hatchet head with a recently broken handle. Curiously, no blood was found on any of the potential weapons. In fact, no blood was found anywhere aside from the victims' bodies. It should be mentioned, as it were, the police were not the most proactive when it came to containing the scene. Of course, this is to be expected. In the early 19th century, it was common for looky-loos to trample crime scenes. The horrid scene unfolding at the Borden house was of no exception. Curious neighbors crowded the house, hoping to catch a glimpse of the gruesome scene. Police, for their part, failed to examine either Maggie or Lizzie for any signs of blood or other incriminating evidence on them. What's more is they were allowed to clean up the scene quite quickly and of their own volition. Later, as you can imagine, the police would be criticized for their shoddy police work. Because of the lack of evidence suggesting that a stranger had entered the Borden residence, suspicion befell on those closest to Andrew and Abby. Emma was not physically present at the time of the crime, so she was pretty immediately ruled out. Maggie, the maid, was also ruled out as a suspect, although it's unclear as to why. Police and locals focalized all too intently and rather immediately on Lizzie. Perhaps it was her off-putting demeanor that drew her into the crosswires of the law. Lizzie was a hard woman to pin down and seemed to oscillate between many states. She was of the elite in name and wealth, but her father had more or less regulated her to spinsterhood by way of his judgmental nature. She coveted a living situation on the hill, a life enjoyed by many of her Borden kin. Instead, she was regulated to a life in a cold house, both metaphorically and literally, devoid of any of the finer comforts that their privileged status could afford. Brimming with wealth, she sought to give to charity. Perhaps seethingly inward with rage, she built roosts for animals that would otherwise be thought of as mere pests. This, of course, depends on which story you believe. Regardless, when it came time to judging their fellow peer, the trial would be one for the ages. As I mentioned before, the bulk of the testimony came from Maggie. She recalled that on the morning of the murders, she was cleaning the windows on the third floor, Abby was cleaning the guest bedroom on the second floor, and Lizzie was busy ironing in the dining room. It's said that when Andrew came home, he inquired as to the whereabouts of his wife. Lizzie is noted as having informed her father that she received a summons to visit a sick friend. However, no such friend ever materialized during the trial to corroborate this information. Lizzie was also quoted as saying that she removed her father's boots when he returned from his walk. But this directly contradicts the fact that in the crime scene photography, it's clearly shown that Andrew Borden was still wearing his boots when he died. So why would Lizzie lie? The only room that was unlocked, apparently, was the kitchen. But all three women were going in and out of the kitchen all morning. And the police, as we said earlier, reasoned that it was unlikely that an intruder had managed to slip into the Borden house unnoticed. What's more, it was unlikely that either of the women would have been spared hearing the sound of two people being cut down so violently, especially Abby, who, you'll remember, fell to the ground after being struck. But Maggie maintained that she was on the third floor, and Lizzie insisted that she was in the barn loft at the time of the murders. If Abby was already dead when Andrew returned home, and Maggie went to open the door for him, why did she not spot Abby's body on the second floor? When initially questioned by the police, much was said of Lizzie's demeanor. In some records, she's described as being eerily calm. In others, her answers were confusing and sometimes contradictory. It would later transpire that she was given a heavy dose of morphine to calm her nerves. If the initial suspicion surrounded both Maggie and Lizzie, Maggie's involvement quickly fell by the wayside as the cumulative, albeit circumstantial, evidence against Lizzie began to mount. In addition to offering shady alibis and strange, unsubstantiated information, it also transpired that Lizzie had attempted to buy prussic acid on August 3rd, the day before the murders. And you'll recall that the Borden household had fallen sick shortly before the murders took place. When questioned about this, though, Lizzie claimed that the substance was used to clean her furs. Rumors began to swirl that Andrew Borden's will was missing following the murders. It was said that the will may have indicated that upon his death, the bulk of his fortune was to be given to his new wife, leaving his daughters more or less bereft. However, if Abby were to die first, then the Borden fortune would undisputably go to the Borden sisters. The intricacies of this claim haven't been substantiated, but it did add an aura of callousness to the whole affair. Stories like that of the will and the prussic acid colored the public's opinion of the case. Newspapers at the time seemed to delight in overblowing the bitter nature of Lizzie and Abby's relationship, painting them as perpetual enemies. However, there was no outward evidence to support this, and the Cinderella angle seems to be another exaggeration bolstered by the press. However, that isn't to say that the Borden household wasn't contentious, but was it enough to lead to murder? The police's general incompetence was also put on trial during the Borden hearing. On the first night following the murders, friends of the family had been allowed to stay in the Borden house overnight, presumably to comfort the girls. One of these friends, Alice Russell, had been witnessed by police that night entering the cellar with Lizzie. The women are said to have been carrying a kerosene lamp and a slop pail, and Lizzie was later seen bent over a sink. However, she was never interrupted or questioned by police during this event. Perhaps she was cleaning the house of the aftermath of the carnage as some sort of involuntary trauma response, or perhaps she was ridding herself of evidence. This leads us to another tale that floats in the aura of Lizzie Borden's case. It's said that in the days following the murders, Lizzie was caught burning a dress in the kitchen stove. This statement was presented by none other than Alice Russell. The dress, she claimed, had been ruined by paint streaks. Police never examined the dress, and when this event was brought up in court, the prosecution never challenged the defense's rebuttal any further. Very, very strange. Lizzie Borden's story is infamous, and her trial is an example of how a story that is sensationalized can play into the aura of a real-life case, more often than not, emphasizing the more macabre elements of the affair, or at least the elements that are considered interesting. More so, Lizzie's trial is an example of how circumstantial evidence, when presented in a court of law, should not be enough to lead an accused to the gallows. Luckily for Lizzie, the jury also understood this and found that they were unable to find her guilty. On June 23, 1893, Lizzie Borden was acquitted. She left the courthouse a free woman, exclaiming that she was the happiest woman in the world. Lizzie went on to live the remainder of her life in Fall River. She inherited her father's wealth, which she split with her sister. Emma Borden was always a strong defender of her sister, and the two lived together for a long time. In fact, after first settling various claims with the Durfee family, Lizzie and Emma Borden bought a house on the hill, which they named Maplecroft. It was a giant Victorian home with 8 bedrooms, 4 bathrooms, and 6 fireplaces. They hired live-in housekeepers and even a coachman. Finally, they had the life that they felt they deserved and perhaps secretly coveted. Although she was ultimately acquitted and found her wealth and station, Lizzie, who changed her name to Lizbeth, lost a lot following the trial. Friends and acquaintances distanced themselves from her. In Fall River, she was mostly ostracized. Lizzie also never wore mourning clothes and began to act in a way that diametrically opposed her father in life. She flaunted her wealth. Perhaps finding her sordid story too entertaining to ignore, she was able to cultivate a social circle in Boston and New York, surrounding herself with famous actors. One of them, Nance O'Neill, was even reputed to be her lover. After Lizzie threw a lavish party for Nance at Maplecroft, Emma moved out. The sisters never spoke again. Lizzie's story is fascinating and leaves a complex legacy. From the outset, it appears that in a vacuum, the murders committed in the Borden house must have been done by someone who had a vendetta against them. Nothing appeared to have been stolen. The goal was to end the lives of Abby and Andrew. And the more we think about the case, the least certain we are about the perpetrator. Could it have been Uncle Morse? Frustrated after a tense discussion with Andrew that very same morning? Could it have been the Irish maid, Maggie, unsatisfied at her station in life and who may have seemingly snapped? What about this mysterious friend who had beckoned Abby for a visit? But more importantly, what about Lizzie? Calm, charitable, almost innocuous Lizzie. So close to having the life she thought she deserved on the hill, but reduced to living a life of reluctant spinsterhood and under the unrelenting control of her father and the new woman. One thing we know for certain, when a good story is told, anyone can believe anything. Well, that's it for us today. I hope you guys enjoyed this episode, and I will see you next time on Haunted History.